Many of you have followed the painful and infuriating saga of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks, who has been held in London's notorious maximum security Belmarsh prison for almost 5 years now. Before that, he was in self-imposed exile in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The CIA a few years ago made plans to kill or to kidnap Julian in broad daylight in the streets of London if the US government's request to extradite him were to be unsuccessful. But that request is pending and is likely to go forward in the near future. The big question then is whether the US Justice Department will offer Julian a deal he can live with or whether he'll be forced to go onto trial for his life. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Julian Assange is probably the most famous transparency absolutist in the world. It was Julian and WikiLeaks who told us through the release of the Bradley, now Chelsea Manning documents, that the US had committed war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was Julian and WikiLeaks who told us through the release of the Vault 7 documents that the CIA could remotely take over control of a person's car by hacking into the computer and then could force the car off the road or off a bridge or into a tree. We learned that the CIA could take over a person's smart TV and turn the speaker into a microphone all while the TV appeared to be off. We learned about international corruption, about money laundering and fraud, all thanks to Julian Assange. It was because of this never-ending quest for transparency that the CIA sought to kidnap or kill Julian, and the US Department of Justice charged him with multiple counts of espionage and other crimes amounting to 175 years in prison. Julian famously took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy, where he was spied on relentlessly by the CIA, the Ecuadorians, and the British, until the Ecuadorians turned on him and handed him over to British authorities. He's been imprisoned in harsh conditions ever since, as the US has tried to have him extradited. This is not a partisan issue in the United States. Republican Donald Trump charged Julian with espionage, an irony, since Trump is now charged with multiple counts of espionage himself. But Democrat Joe Biden continued the prosecution and has actively sought Julian's extradition. The bottom line is this. It is the CIA that's calling the shots in this case. The CIA considers itself to be the victim here. And they won't stop until WikiLeaks is ruined and Julian Assange is either in prison for the rest of his life or dead. We have two guests today, both of whom are close to Julian Assange and both of whom are intimately knowledgeable of the challenges that he faces. Joe Loria is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. He's a veteran foreign affairs journalist and has written for The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, The London Daily Telegraph, and other outlets. Randy Credico is a longtime comedian and social justice activist, the former director of the William M. Kunstler Fund for Social Justice, and the host of the radio show Live on the Fly, which airs on New York's WBAI radio. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Joe, I'd like to begin with you. You've attended pretty much every court hearing that Julian's been involved in from the very beginning. Things seem to have finally come to a head. In his most recent appeal, Julian's attorneys argued that the U.S. Justice Department had not provided assurances that Julian would not be executed if extradited to the United States. Was that a paperwork exercise, or is that a real fear?
It's inexplicable why, after 4 years now, this routine matter where Britain, when it is being asked to extradite someone to a state that has the death penalty, routinely asks for an assurance from that state that in this particular case it would not be sought. And the Home Office never asked for that. And we know that because, and I was sitting in the courtroom right there, right in the row between the judge and behind me were the lawyers, the Ben Watson, who was a King's Counselor for the Home Office. He said that they never asked U.S. for this assurance. I find that extraordinary. The U.S. never offered an assurance. Again, this is routine. Why was that not happen? This is something that no one could really fully understand. There's some speculation that it's a way for the U.S. to get out of this situation, that it's become politically untenable for them, given the incredible pressure that's been put on them by heads of state, by every human rights organization, press freedom organization, etc. And, of course, Joe Biden doesn't want Julian Assange coming, showing up on the U.S. shores with in chains, a journalist in chains to stand trial just outside Washington for publishing true information about U.S. state crimes. But that means it could be kicked down the road past the November election. This seems to be something else. And what's really important here about this, John, is that the high court, the two high court judges that have heard Julian's the hearing on February 20 and 21, what we're talking about here. This is, by the way, just a hearing so that Julian Assange could have an appeal. This is an appeal about an appeal, because he had been denied the right to have an appeal or to leave for an appeal. So those judges said in their 66-page ruling two very important things. On the death penalty, they were extremely blunt, and I'm going to quote. They said if extradition of Assange would, quote, be contrary to the convention rights, that's the European Convention on Human Rights, under the British Human Rights Act of 1998, Article 3, which is against torture, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment, in other words, the death penalty. In other words, if the extradition is contrary to that right, then extradition must be refused. That means without the assurance from the United States that they will not seek the death penalty, this is an automatic refusal of the extradition. Julian Assange goes free. Why haven't they given that assurance yet? Now, Craig Murray, who was on our webcast at Consortium News a few days ago, said he believed that at the last minute the U.S. would give this assurance on the death penalty. We will remain to be seen. If they do, then there's a two-week period where the lawyers for Assange could challenge that assurance to see whether it is in fact a valid one or not. And I did a little research about this today, and I discovered that the attorney general must, in a federal capital punishment case, the prosecutors cannot just ask for it. They need to go through a process that includes the attorney general signing off on this to have the death penalty. I would assume that Merrick Garland would have to also approve this assurance not to seek the death penalty. And then just to add, there's one other right that Assange has to be assured he would have. And this is really an important one. And that is in conjunction with Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is what the British courts go by. The equivalent of Article 10, freedom of expression, is the First Amendment in the United States. So the court has asked the U.S. to assure he would have First Amendment rights as well. And we know that both Mike Pompeo, CIA director, and Gordon Cromberg, the chief prosecutor here, both said that Assange would not have First Amendment rights, or that they could be taken from him. And there was a Supreme Court decision that said that non-U.S. citizens have no First Amendment rights, if they, especially if they've committed the alleged crime outside the United States, which is the case here. So the fact is, though, and we had Marjorie Cohn on that same webcast saying that the separation of powers in the U.S. means that the executive branch, the Department of Justice, cannot interfere with what a court would say about whether those rights would be granted or not. So the U.S. cannot grant First Amendment rights to Julian Assange. Cannot do it because of that Supreme Court decision, or because it's up to the judge whether he would get those rights or not. And the Supreme Court again ruled in a case that the foreigners do not have First Amendment rights. So what does that mean? Well, here's where there's a difference, because the High Court in their ruling said, and I quote this, that if Assange is, quote, not permitted to rely on the First Amendment, then it is arguable that his extradition would be incompatible with Article 10 of the convention. In that case, Julian would be free. But unlike the ironclad language, the blunt language on the death penalty, if they don't give the assurance, he has to be discharged. He's gone, free, no extradition. On the free speech issue, there's some wiggle room in the language of the court, saying that he only has an arguable case. So that would be argued apparently at the appeals court. But just to finish, I would point out that the UK Crown Prosecution Service on their website says that in all extradition cases, the judge must consider whether extradition would be compatible with the requested person's human rights. And if the judge finds that extradition would not be compatible with the required person's human rights, that person's extradition cannot be ordered and the judge must discharge them. So included in those human rights is Article 10. So according to the Crown Prosecution Service, he would have to be released as well. On the fact that he didn't get an assurance on First Amendment or free speech rights, which the U.S. Department of Justice cannot issue because it's up to the judge and the Supreme Court has decided a foreigner doesn't have those rights. So I'm thinking it's looking a lot better for Julian Assange at first glance in this very complicated ruling.
Right. Randy, you're also tied to the various Assange support groups. Actually, I'll even go farther than that. You do more than just about anybody I know in the Assange support groups, as well as Julian's wife and to some of his more prominent supporters. What are you hearing about plans for extradition? How are those closest to Julian preparing for it? And what do they expect to do once he gets to the United States?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not really that directly tied to them. They have their campaign, and I'm kind of a free rover out there. And I believe that mobilizing and organizing, getting on the street with the masses in the street is the only thing that will save him. And that's why you've seen me out there on the street, I would say, 150 days. The last year and a half on a trip. So taking it to the people and trying to organize there rather than just doing it through the court system and on his birthday or on some kind of anniversary, International Press Freedom Day. I think it's something that has to be pursued on a daily basis, if you can do it on a daily basis.
Joe, we've been hearing many rumors over the past several weeks that Justice Department prosecutors and Julian's attorneys are involved in talks.
President Biden, do you have a response to Australia's request that you end Julian Assange's prosecution?
I didn't hear you.
Do you have a response to Australia's request that you end Julian Assange's prosecution?
We're considering.
Not necessarily in negotiations, but in talks that might result in Julian accepting some sort of a plea deal in exchange for time served. He would then be expelled back to Australia, presumably, where he could then live in freedom with his wife and children. What are you hearing? Are these serious talks, and are they at an advanced stage?
Well, I do know that there were definitely talks at some point. And then Julian Assange, as you pointed out on Sputnik Radio last week, John, that you knew that there was a deal and Julian turned it down because he'd have to agree to the Espionage Act, which is an extremely courageous thing for him to have done, denying his own freedom, his personal freedom, to get the hell out of Belmarsh prison because he did not want a future journalist to be charged with espionage. So that deal fell apart. When you look at the language of the statement that Barry Pollack, Julian's lawyer in Washington, said, it sounds like, and a lot of people, I think, misinterpreted this, that there is no talks. But if you look at it carefully, it's a very lawyerly constructed statement. Look at the language. It says that the Justice Department has shown no intention to resolve this matter. That doesn't mean they haven't tried. It means it's a way of saying we're disappointed because they're not really serious about this. But not that they haven't had discussions. But you do get the impression that right now there are no discussions going on now. So they came to a standstill, most likely because Julian turned down that plea deal that had already been discussed. But there are new parameters now that might be possible here, John. And this was first brought up by Bruce Afron, and a constitutional lawyer, in our webcast of last August, when he pointed out that Julian may be able to plea to a mishandling of classified material charge, which is a misdemeanor with a 5-year maximum term, which he's already served 5 years in Belmarsh. So theoretically, if he agreed to that, and the U.S. allowed that, he could walk free. He wouldn't even have to go to Australia for any more time. This is a possibility first raised by Bruce Afron in August. And Bruce also said he would have to do that remotely. In other words, from London. There's nothing against the rules of the law for someone who's outside the United States to enter into plea agreement remotely from another country. Doesn't have to come to the U.S. And that is something he will not do. Gabriel Shipton, Julian's brother, had made it very clear there's no way he's going to go there because the U.S. could change their mind once he arrived. Funny enough, that Wall Street Journal article of now 2 weeks ago talked about mishandling classified information and doing a remote plea. The exact same things that Bruce Afron said in our webcast last August. So this would be something Julian Assange, I think, could agree to. A misdemeanor. It would have to be conspiracy to mishandle classified data because the law as it's written is for government employees. That's the one I think Trump was charged under. They didn't charge Biden under. So he'd have to go into a conspiracy with Chelsea Manning, who was a government employee, to mishandle classified data, and he'd have to do it remotely. If those are the terms, I think that Julian could agree to that. And I also think that he seems to be maybe in the driver's seat a lot more than I had thought previously, considering what I just said about those two assurances. They can't give the assurance on the First Amendment. And if Crown Prosecution Service is right, he cannot be extradited then. Certainly on the death penalty assurance, he cannot be extradited unless they get that. So that probably would come through. If they miss the April 16 deadline for those assurances, then we'll have an appeal and it gets kicked down the road. So I think that is a plea deal, John, that Assange could take if the U.S. gives it to him.
Randy, in the event that Julian is indeed extradited, activists like you will take up the mantle of his defense on the street. You've organized countless actions in support of Julian Assange, including very well-received advertising trucks. What do you expect to do when he arrives in the United States for trial?
Well, I don't expect him to arrive in the United States. But if in fact he does arrive in the United States, then the only thing you can do is to carry on organized. We don't have, you know this, I've been in D.C., I've been on the streets of D.C. for so long out there, and yes, you've seen that truck, and I've had it here, and you talk to people on the streets, they're not that interested. The people that are support Julian Assange, are they really gung-ho in support, or just like, you know, as liberals, oh, this is a bad thing. Are they willing to get out there? That's the test.
Yeah.
Are people willing? Do they know?
Yes.
People are on the, here you're on the streets. You want to go directly to the people, and everyone's on their cell phone. And they're not even looking. So you got to grab their attention. It's the new opium den, you know? The whole world on their cell phones all the time. They should go to cell phone anonymous meetings.
Isn't that the truth?
I'm telling you, it's a real problem. I go into the subway and I got flyers in my hand in my spare time, and I can't get anybody's attention. It's not because they're reading newspaper magazines or books. They're looking at their cell
phones.
Phone, and they're not reading Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. I can promise you that.
Joe Luria and Randy Credico, thank you so much for being with us. We're just scratching the surface of this important issue. When we come back, we'll talk about what Julian Assange can expect in the United States, and why many of his supporters remain so hopeful. Stay tuned.
When the world's largest democracy votes, the rest of the planet watches. In an emerging multipolar world, India's voice matters. But who will be the power behind it? Watch as almost 1 billion people decide, and billions more react.
У каждого была какая-то своя точка переломная, точка невозврата, как можно сказать.
Здесь все совсем другое. Здесь все быстро и просто.
От России никто не отворачивался. Мы с ней и росли, мы с ней и жили.
Русским был, есть и буду.
Здесь не просто мужчины, здесь лучшие люди. Они лучше нас.
Уход! Уход!
Все будет хорошо. Прорвемся.
Вариантов-то нет. Надо до конца добивать все это мероприятие. Иначе будет только хуже.
Реально бояться можно.
Путина можно бояться, но трусить нельзя. Лучше мы будем здесь воевать, чем они придут туда, к нам домой.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with two important supporters of Julian Assange, journalist and Consortium News editor Joe Loria, and activist and radio host Randy Credico. Joe and Randy, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, John. Good to see you.
Joe, you and I have had conversations about assurances that the Justice Department has given the UK courts and Julian's attorneys, assurances that really are not worth the paper that they're printed on. For example, prosecutors have promised that Julian would not be placed in solitary confinement or in a restrictive prison communications management unit. They don't have the authority to make such a promise. Those decisions are made solely by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. What has been the UK judges' reactions to these promises? Do the judges understand that the promises are empty?
No. I think you're referring to the 2022 October hearing of Julian Assange in the High Court. That was a U.S. appeal to overturn the lower court's decision not to extradite him based on his mental health, his propensity for suicide, and the conditions of U.S. prisons. The judge never asked for assurances then. She didn't have to ask for those assurances. The U.S. said, why didn't she ask us? So they put these assurances in after the trial was lost by them, after the hearing. The extradition hearing was lost by them, and they went to the High Court. And the High Court, without allowing Assange's lawyers to challenge them, which they will be able to this time, that's some progress there as well, decided that they accepted those assurances. They didn't challenge the lower court's judge's decision about the mental health and the condition of U.S. prisons. They just accepted the U.S. promises. And as you point out, John, those decisions are not made by the Department of Justice, by the prosecutors, that where Julian, what prison Julian would go into. It's done by the Bureau of Prisons, but I do also by an input from the CIA, which a former BOP official testified at Julian's extradition hearing about that. The CIA would have input. So at least this time they're going to allow Assange's lawyers to challenge these assurances, because the ones in that other court were not worth the paper they were written on, as Amnesty International pointed out in those very words.
Randy, tell us a little bit about activism on Julian's behalf on the street here in the United States. I've participated in many, many protests, as have you, where there are no more than a dozen people. But then we see video of pro-Assange demonstrations elsewhere around the world, in Sydney, in London, in Berlin, where there are tens of thousands of people participating. Right. Why are we not seeing those numbers in the U.S., and do you expect that to change?
The same way you don't see a lot of people in the streets in Europe out there protesting for Momia or for Leonard Peltier, I suppose. They don't know about the case, and people here don't know about the case. Those who do, those who are informed, who are active, this is not, we don't have the kind of energy and the kind of commitment that we had in the 60s and the 80s when people were out there marching for civil rights and the gay rights and of course, to end the war in Vietnam, and then in the 80s and in Central America. I mean, I'm a product of that. And so at this point, you don't see that many people. It's not, I know, in DC, you see 10 or 12 people there.
That's
about it. And that's the most difficult nut to crack. And the one, ironically, that's the most important one to crack is to get a lot of people on the streets in DC.
Yes.
That's been the most resistant of all the cities that I've been in. In New York City, it's better. We have these events in front of the British consulate. We just had one. There was about 200 people there. So, and then whenever Roger Waters, who wasn't there this last time on the 20th of February, but in the past when he would show up, or Susan Sarandon would show up, you draw more people.
Yep.
But if you did it once a week, you draw 9, 10, 12 people. It's very difficult. And D.C., you draw, and there's some hardcore supporters of them. I mean, you're going to get 4 or 5 people in front of the Justice Department or in front of the White House. You know, when I'm there, just me and the truck driver are on the street, you know, driving around and just trying to muster up some kind of energy and visibility going in front of the Alexandria Courthouse. That's where people should be.
Yes.
If there was a big a big you know, support group down there. There isn't. There's a hardcore group down there, and but there's not a huge group of medium supporters of Assange to be out there. I mean, they should be out in front of that courthouse in Alexandria, but it's so far away. That's not like a liberal city there in Alexandria or that part of Alexandria. So I mean, it's inundated with you know, national security state current and former personnel. So that's where the you draw the jury pool. And then, of course, it's just like it's hard to get to. But that's the one. That's the place that I would be if I could get people out there. I drive by it all the time. I never see anybody except for the time you and I were there to see Daniel Hale.
Yes.
That was the biggest demonstration I've ever seen in front of that building.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, yes. And you know, what's funny is that courthouse lends itself to demonstrations. There's a nice big plaza right in front of it that's perfect for demonstrations.
We'll haven't seen anything that perfect since Cadman Plaza in Brooklyn, where I used to demonstrate against the New York's racist Rockefeller drug laws. I'd go out in front of Cadman Plaza, it's perfect. And the only thing that compares to that is what's outside of the Alexandria Eastern District of Virginia courthouse.
Joe, you and I have both spoken with mainstream American journalists who either will not take a position on Julian's case or who are hostile to him. And this is despite the fact that they and their news outlets have used the information that WikiLeaks has revealed in their own reporting. One important journalist with whom I spoke said that Julian is not a journalist, but an activist. Even if people don't believe he's a journalist, though, they have to concede that he's a publisher. Why is there so much pushback in the American media?
There's a schizophrenia in the mainstream media. I mean, I used to be for more than 20 years in the mainstream media, and I know the pressures that are involved there, what is allowed and what's not allowed. You just know this. If you want to survive, and if you're a careerist, as almost everyone is in the mainstream media, you're going to be doing what you need to do to get ahead. And you're at the schizophrenia of the New York Times putting out a statement with Der Spiegel, with El Pais, with Le Monde, and with The Guardian, the five partners of Julian, mainstream partners of Julian in the 2010 publication, that has got him in trouble right now, that he's been indicted on, that's in the actual indictment. They put out a statement saying, drop the case, because this is a threat to the First Amendment, to the free press. So on that level, could have been pushed by their lawyers. I mean, the lawyers at the New York Times and the other publications may have said, you better put this out here. But I think they were reluctant about putting that out because for the most, that's one side of it. And on the other side, they are disparaging him, as you just said. They don't see him as a journalist because he is not protecting the establishment's interests. He's undermining and challenging and threatening those interests. And the whole role of the mainstream journalist is to support the agenda of the United States, particularly in foreign affairs, whatnot. You're not going to have a mainstream journalist agreeing with Julian Assange and what he did. However, they did publish those documents. So this is why there's this real internal conflict going on, I think, in the mainstream. On the one hand, they know it's a threat to the First Amendment. On the other hand, they say he's not a journalist. On the one hand, they published what he gave them because they had to. Had they not, they would have been exposed as the frauds they generally are.
Joe Loria and Randy Credico, thanks so much for being with us. I'd like to think that it is not adversity that makes us the people we are, so much as it is the way we respond to adversity. Julian Assange is one of the toughest and the most resilient people I have ever met. He's paying a huge personal price for what he believes in, but he's not doing it for himself. He's doing it for all of us. And now it's up to us to be there for him. I'd like to thank our guests, Joe Loria and Randy Credico, for joining us and providing their insights. And thanks to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Find me on Substack at John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.